because not many people in the Air Force. The Air Force is pretty young. We're only 69 years old. The other services are 241 years old, so a little bit different for them. And so I said, okay. And then she said, the other thing is you need to talk to the different services along with the National Guard. And so when I came up for general, I had not three, but four specialties. Most people only have two max. And I had worked two assignments with the Reserve and the Guard. I had worked four assignments with the Army, Navy, and Marines and Coast Guard. And so they go, wow, you have done some strange things. I said, yes, I have. Now, it could have gone either way. They could have said, who is this nutcase and why can't she keep a job? Or they could say, which is what they said, is you're one of the future leaders of the Department of Defense.
Wow. That's... Now, Mary, I'd love to talk to you about the importance of taking risks in your career. What you just touched on was you took a risk and it paid off. So how important is risk taking and how can young women overcome that fear? Because taking risks can be really scary.
Okay, the first thing I want to tell you is that I'm an introvert. And I hardly talked when I was in elementary school. My teacher actually had to tell me, she said, sweetheart, now you're very smart, but it doesn't really count if nobody knows it. So she made me start talking. She had me doing programs, and I'm sure some of you, how many of you can relate to that? I could hear my knees knocking. I thought, I'm going to throw up. I'm going to faint. Never happened. But I felt like it did. When I went to middle school, she passed me on to the English teachers. They did the same thing. And when I got in high school, they put me on the debate team. That's why I talk faster than some Texans, you know. But you have to represent yourself. And so what I learned was to be calm inside. Said, this will work out, you're not going to faint, you're not going to throw up, and you really are smart. And so I learned that in today's environment, and it's always been today's environment, no matter what year it was, you know, you have to be able to defend yourself. You have to be able to stand up. So I'm not some crazy person. I don't talk crazy to people. I don't yell and scream at people. I use very soft voice, as a matter of fact. But I tell them what is going on, tell them my position, and you have to do that. And if we look at the conference here today, a lot of presentations you hear are from women talking about what? Number one, they listen to their gut. Because when I came in the Air Force, people thought I was crazy. And there were some people actually came up to me and they said, now, are women in the military still prostitutes? And I said, well, I hope not, because my parents would be very upset if they thought I was, you know. So you have to think, build up your own sense of self-confidence and listen to yourself. Listen to that inside voice. Because there are many things that I did that people were just shaking their head. There she goes again. But guess what? It worked out for me. But one of the things I was committed to it. I was committed. It's okay to be afraid. It's okay to get information from other people. Get three or four people and say, hey, I was thinking about this. What do you think? Because they might have a different perspective just based on their experience and their age. But ultimately, you make a decision. But if you're not willing to take a risk, it will be very difficult to get anywhere in this world. And if you want to make a difference, even your own personal life, it will be very difficult to do unless you're willing to take a risk. And again, nobody's going to kill you. The world is not going to stop rotating. That's what I say to myself all the time. What's the worst thing that can happen? Not much. It just didn't work out. And if it didn't work out, I looked at what worked, what didn't. And when I look at failure as I failed to get the result that I was looking for. What can I do about that? How can I change it? I didn't look at failure as, you know, never ending and never happened. Now, maybe if I wanted to be a neurosurgeon, that might be a problem. But short of that, we can do a lot. So you have to take a risk. You need to take a risk. But get inside, decide inside yourself, I can do this. And depend on yourself, get good information, make a decision, then go for it.
And Andy and Madhvi, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this topic of risk-taking as well and how you overcame that fear in taking a risk.
I think you constantly, every year I decide to do something scary. To back up, and the reason for that is because I feel as though if I'm not failing, making mistakes at something, then I'm not growing, that I'm not pushing myself hard enough. Because when you're out on your growing edge, you are going to make mistakes. That's how you recover, that builds your confidence. It's that, no, wait, I can fail and pick myself up again and try again, change something a little bit and succeed. And one example was I'd taken a leadership class where the final step was this presentation before senior leadership in our company, And I don't really like being on a stage and talking to rooms full of people, but I really don't like being on a stage and talking to my boss's 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 boss. And that's what that was. And afterward, I decided as a treat, I would go to Puerto Rico. It was my birthday. And I decided, Andy, after like a day of sitting on the beach, you're going to get bored. You should sign up for one of these adventure tours. That was a little more risk-taking than I really needed. We did rope bridges and zip lines, and we rappelled off the side of a cliff to get to this cave where there was this underground river. And I was not as nervous at the top of that cliff, clipping onto the rope, as I was on stage. Like, it just added a little bit of crazy perspective. So I would embrace that, you know, feeling in your tummy that kind of says, you've never done this before, it's a little scary. Because once you get past it, the next time you're in that place, you know you can handle it. It's just the feeling in your tummy. It's not the end of the world. You can do this. And just build on that. And if it's been a while since you've been that nervous, go do something that makes you that nervous. Go try something new.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. Sometimes it's like, you know, you get so comfortable in your comfort zone, you just know, you know, this is, you're on autopilot. I think that's the time when it's time to realize that you need to push yourself a little bit. Because just following your gut, taking that risk, and then settling down is not the plan. Like, my plan wasn't like, you know, I'm going to take that assignment and switch into the nonprofit sector, and then everything is going to settle. That is not the plan. Because then, as Andy said, you stop growing. You just, like, feel you're too comfortable in your comfort zone. Everything is just happening. It's on autopilot. That's kind of a wake-up call to try and go out and do something that's, if not crazy, then at least exciting. It gets you a fresh perspective. Just to give you some context of my story, so once I got at Technovation, I was like, wow, this is really what I wanted to do. And then I started, like, you know, moving things around. I became the senior director, and I was like, started saying a lot of no's to my CEO. This week, we cannot do this, we cannot do that. There was a point where, before I got promoted, there was a point where I was like, I had a very honest conversation with our CEO. I was like, I don't think this is going to work. We, like, you know, this is another strategy that we should do. And that was a lot of risk-taking. And our CEO is amazing. She is a huge risk-taker. But I guess she didn't realize that she had got another one on her team. So two on the same team was a bit too much for the organization. And there was a point I still remember today when I came back. It was around this time, before the holidays last year. I came back home and said to my husband, I think I need to find another job. She's going to fire me. Because there had been constant instances where I was like, Tara, we can't do this. We can't do this. And she was like, I was not sure what's going on. So I was like, okay. I, in my head, I was like, you know, after the holidays, I should start, like, job searching. This is not going to last for too long. And then a couple of months later, my CEO called me and said, like, we have an opening for the senior director position. We think you're a good fit. Do you want to apply? And I was like, does Tara know about this? I was like, have you talked to the CEO? Does she really know? Because I was under the impression. So it's what I'm trying to communicate is, like, even when you, like, you know, you make a decision, like, you know, you want to go into the army, you want to go into a particular career, and that's not the point, that's not the goal, because you are someone who has so much potential that's going, which you don't know, which you really, none of you know the amount of potential that you have. And the only way that you can express is by taking risk. And trust me, you will amaze yourself as well. So just, like, try to come out of your comfort zone. Try to do something that you think you can't do. You will be surprised by the results.
I want to say one last thing that I work in almost in a male environment. Sometimes we as girls tend to, when we look at a mentor or a friend or something, we want to find people who can be all things to us. And that's just not what you need to do when you look for a mentor. You need to look at the areas where you find yourself falling short and find somebody who can help you with that. And so if you know you don't know anything about money, well, don't go to somebody who doesn't have any trying to get them to help you learn something about money, you know. And so then, you know, if you struggle with public speaking, then you should get somebody who seems to be comfortable with that and say, well, listen, can I just, you know, just kind of run this over you? Would you listen to my speeches? So you might really have, as you grow, four or five mentors. And, oh, by the way, it never stops. So I'm always talking to people who I can learn from. And it doesn't always mean there's somebody above you. It can be your peer. It could even be somebody not, because the world changed so fast, younger than you, who knows how to do something that you've never even thought about, you know? And then it could be somebody who's more mature, who has years of experience. But when you look for a mentor, it's not a person. You look for who has the skill set that I need to be successful.
And now, before we open it up to audience Q&A, I'd love to hear if you each have one kind of final closing, either best piece of advice or something we haven't touched on yet that you'd love to express.
Mine is a quote by Eric Hoffer, and he said, "In times of change, learners shall inherit the earth, while the learned, those who think they know everything, will find themselves in a world that no longer exists." Keep up.
I would say be supportive of each other. Be supportive of yourself. We've talked a lot about mentors, but you also can mentor. And that kind of giving back, that buoyancy, that positivity, you want that. You want that to infuse your life. No matter what it is you choose to do, just think about how you can help each other, help your friends. Choose people for your posse who are positive. I have lots of friends and acquaintances, and it's not that, you know, I'm not friends with this person because she's not positive, but I know that in order to get where I want to go, I'm going to have to be selective and associate with people who are going to be positive about me getting there in my journey and reciprocate that for them, so...
Yeah, and I would just add, you know, we all talk about bucket lists, like, you know, this is what I want to do, this is the holiday I want to take. I usually tell most of the girls who come on Technovation that you should have an annual bucket, like a bucket list for each year, where you are going to try out something new, something that you haven't experienced. It's not like you want to become, you want to go into finance and, you know, you're going to take a course in that. That is still your path. But try and do something that you think is You don't even in your head think that that is something that you will be successful at or something that is kind of exciting and scary, but try every year to do something that's a little bit outside your comfort zone so that you build those skills, and all that is going to add up. Once you land up at a job, it's not one skill that you're going to use. Life will throw many things at you, and once you keep trying and experimenting with all these things, you build up your own pool of skills. You know you can fall back and then use any of these because you have tried it, tested it, used it earlier.
Great. So now I'd love to open it up to the audience for questions for any one person on the stage or questions that you might want to ask of everyone. And really, this is kind of a, you know, safe, comfortable space. This is all us, you know, I think everyone on the stage has been incredibly vulnerable with their stories already and, you know, admitted to lots of questions and failures they had in their life. And no one should feel like this is being recorded or being tweeted out or anything like that. So really just any question that you have, this is an incredible opportunity to speak to these women. Yes. Oh, do we have a mic coming?
Yeah, there's a mic right there.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure if it's on or not. But you guys talked a lot about how, like, the challenges that you faced as women in the workforce, but I wanted to know about how, like, what are some of the struggles that you faced as women of color in the workforce, and how can young women of color learn to combat those things? So, yeah.
It's kind of interesting. I was in the military, and so my issue was a gender issue, not a race issue. You could have been purple, and they would have cared less, you know. And so, you know, one of my perspective is always be at the top of your game, you know, and I mean, that's just the way things are right now. So you need to be smart so somebody wants you to be on their team, and then you need to carry yourself in such a way that people feel like they can't mistreat you just because the color of your skin.
I have learned to be confident in my perspective and in my point of view. In my business, we try and make sure that we cover all the angles. And what I've come to realize is that people will hire you because you're different and then be surprised that, oh my gosh, she doesn't think the way we do. What the heck do we do with that? And sometimes I have to reflect back to them and say, look, you know, I've learned to be confident also in my coworkers that when that happens, it's not like they're purposely trying to get under my skin. it's just a miscommunication or a difference in perspective. And so I will take someone aside or say something to kind of say, hey, are we thinking about it this way? Because in my experience, it doesn't happen that way for everyone. And then knowing that that is a value to my boss, to my company, that just because I'm different doesn't mean it's wrong. You know what I mean? Yeah. A little bit? Okay.
Yeah, for me, it was very interesting because I moved to this country much later, so I had to culturally adapt as well. So to me, to battle that, you know, that stereotype outside, I had to first battle it in my own head. I had to convince myself that no matter what people are thinking that I'm different, I had to convince myself first, like, you know, that's not that way. I bring a different skill set. And then I realized something very interesting. No matter who you are, there is always a stereotype for you. Either you're a female, you are a woman of color, or you are a mother, you are a working mom, there is always going to be a stereotype that people are going to fit you into. And that goes for men as well. Either you're a white male, or like if you are a male who's from South Asia, you need to be a software engineer. You can't be anything else. So what I'm trying to communicate is it's a lot of battles. I felt it's a lot of battle in my own head that I need to fight this. You know, they're stereotyping me as a female, as a working mom, as a woman of color. I was like, whoever else is stereotyping me is also in another stereotype bracket. So that gave me a little bit of calmness to deal with the situation rather than always being like, you know, I'm aggressive fighting mode. I need to fight the stereotype. I need to clear this. Like, if you clear that, you'll end up in another stereotype. And it is a conscious effort, but it takes away a lot of your mental energy. So if you're at peace with yourself, like, okay, figuring it out, there is someone else who's another stereotype, we will figure this out, at least gives you, when you're speaking, you come from a space of confidence and also calmness. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes when you are battling stereotypes, I have realized, at least for me, that was my personality. I came across as very aggressive. So I had to take that internal, you know, chatter in my mind, figure that out before I even tried and went out and addressed this to the external world. Okay.
Well, thank you, guys.
Would you come to the mic, please?
Throughout this whole time y'all have been talking, y'all talking about risks that y'all have taken and achieved throughout taking these risks. Has there ever been a time where you've taken a risk and it's totally backfired on you?
My marriage. That's not where you were going, right? See. I think there's a tendency, at least in my mind, to turn things into a positive. So it's kind of hard kind of thinking of a failure that I don't feel like worked out in the end or that I didn't learn something from. When we're talking about risk, I think we're all talking about calculated risk, where you're going in and weighing what are the rewards. If I achieve this, what am I going to get out of it? And if I fail, what's the worst case scenario? Will I still learn something? Will this expose me to something new? So it's not just, you know, throwing yourself into things. You're really being strategic when you're thinking about these things. So I'm going to think, I'm stalling because I'm trying to think of a failure that I absolutely just would never, ever, never, ever, ever, never do again. But
I think that this goes back to what we said at the very beginning, is that when you look at failure or something didn't work out, mm-hmm. then it's like, okay, well, then that wasn't for me. So what it was is a lesson learned, not so much as, oh, my God, I failed and I'll never recover from that. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got to learn to teach our younger women about resiliency. You know, so I've not had anything in my life that worked out that was just a complete failure. I really haven't. You know, and if I did something and thought, well, I could have made a better decision than that. Well, now I know better for next time. So get that out of your mind that about failing stuff. It failed to work. It wasn't for me. Or it failed to work. I need to have worked a little differently, a little harder, a little smarter to do that and do that and move on. Don't look at it as something you just have to hold on to for some horrible thing that happened. No,
failure is not like a reflection of you or who you are. It's the behavior. You know, you took a risk, you did something, it didn't work out. You're not a failure.
Yeah, and once you're in the middle of it, honestly, it looks like it's failure. Nothing is going to, like, you know, you can't figure things out. But once you move past that, that's when all the lessons come in. That's when you start realizing. Like, when I moved to this country, I moved when I got married and moved to this country. I came on the H-4 visa, which I don't know if anybody of you know is the worst visa to come on, because you come on a spouse's visa where you can't work. So here I was at the university, a PhD. I fought all through my life for this, and here I'm in the U.S. for one whole year where I couldn't apply for a job. And that to me was like, you know, this is counterproductive. Like, I've like done everything wrong that I could. But now when I look back, I volunteered so much during that 1 year that gave me so much skill set, that gave me the cultural adaptability that I needed to get into the job market. So everything works out when you, like, you can connect the dots looking back, not when you're actually in the middle of it or looking forward. So things get figured out once you step out of it. But I'm sure we all have had our own moments of failure and struggle.
Great. Now let's take one last question over here.
So sort of like to follow that, sorry, could you share moments where you felt weak? Not so much as failures where stuff didn't work out, as like experience where you felt weak and wanted to quit.
I have felt that all, and I still continue to feel it. I don't think I've like figured it out, because the idea is not like I was saying, like you make a decision and you get settled in it. There are even moments now, like I can give you several moments in my life where I was like, I can't do this. Starting from my PhD, there was a point I walked into my supervisor's room. I'm like, I don't want to do this. I just don't. I feel so lonely. Well, I even don't know why did I sign up for this PhD program. It's not for me. As I said, when I came to the States, I was like, I can't get a job. And I used to like literally cry every day that I want to go back to my country. So I have had so many moments where I've just wanted to quit. But I can tell you one thing that kept me going on was my network. You need to have, whether it's your family, whether it's your friend, whether it's, you will always, and even today, it's not that I've figured it out. It's like, I can tell you several instances in the past 2 months where I'm like, I don't know where this is going. And it's not exactly about, like, you know, my career or big piece. These are small things that I'm doing. I still come across those. But I always have, and that's, I think, what is the value of your mentor network and your family is. I have a safety net to fall back on. I'm like, these are the trouble. I'm feeling very weak. And it's always okay to feel weak. It's not like, you know, you can't verbalize or you can't say that I'm feeling weak. I really don't want to do it. Because once you say that and externalize your thoughts, trust me, you will get a lot of energy out of it as well. Once it's off your chest, you are like, the emotion is gone. You can sit back and think more rationally and think with other people. You don't have to figure this out alone. We all have failures, and it's for us as a community to support each other, whether it's your parents, whether it's your family, whether it's your mentors. Don't ever feel afraid to verbalize that you are feeling weak, because trust me, there will be so many people who will help you figure your way out. None of us have gotten to the place that we have gotten all by ourselves. It's just because of, you know, certain things playing out that we are sitting on this podium today. Trust me, there are many more women who can come and sit here and share their experiences. And these are all women, and this is the entire community that you can fall back on. And you just keep gathering these allies as you move forward. And any time you feel weak, you can fall back on them. Is that helpful?
Fantastic. Well, I think
we're done.
Yeah, I think that was a great note to close on. So I want to give our panelists a round of applause. And now let's give everyone in the audience a round of applause for coming here and being part of it. So, thanks so much, everyone. And enjoy the rest of your day at this incredible conference. So nice to meet everyone.
Good morning, ladies. How are you? My name is Anna Vorenberg, and I'm really pleased to introduce Sophie Krasick, who's going to be running a quick mini session for about 15 minutes on about what you can do to end sexual violence. Her colleague Annie Clark did the keynote this morning. I'm sure you all remember her. And so I'm really excited to introduce Sophie right now. I'm just going to tell you a little bit about her, and then she's going to be telling you what you can do. So Sophie is an anti-sexual violence activist, and she's a co-founder of End Rape on Campus. Prior to her graduation from the University of California, Berkeley, in 2015, she spearheaded several federal complaints against Berkeley and has assisted students nationwide in holding universities accountable under Title IX. Sophie's also a leading advocate for California's groundbreaking affirmative consent law called Yes Means Yes. Have you all heard of that? Sylvie's the reason it happened. So we're pretty proud of her for that. She's featured nationwide on CNN, Wall Street Journal, Guardian, et cetera, BuzzFeed, which we all love, Jezebel, et cetera. She's also a subject in The Hunting Ground, which is a documentary about campus sexual assault. So it's my distinct honor to introduce Sophie, who's going to give you guys some great tools on how to end sexual violence in your environments. Thanks, Sophie.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad that you're all here today. Thank you for being here. So some of the things I'm going to talk about briefly are, you know, how common is this problem? What rights do I have? And what are some tangible ways that you can support survivors and change your campuses? And that's not just colleges and universities, but high schools as well. So sexual violence is unfortunately a really pervasive and prevalent problem. Women experience high rates of sexual violence both in college and over their lifetimes, and the rates against men are also quite high. One in six boys will be sexually assaulted before age 18. LGBTQ students are even more likely to experience sexual violence on college campuses, as well as LGBTQ folks over their lifetimes. The rates of sexual violence are even higher for women of color. These are for cis women of color, and trans women of color have rates that are even higher than this. So it's a very pervasive problem in our culture and on college campuses as well. For a long time, people didn't know that it was so pervasive. And so the reason why we're actually talking about this right now is because survivors started putting a name and a face to this issue, in particular of campus sexual assault on college campuses. And not only that, but we were also talking about how schools had been sweeping this problem under the rug or refusing to adequately address it. So now I want to ask you to think a little bit about how this has affected your own lives, since this is not just an issue in college, but it's an issue in high schools as well. So think about this for just a few minutes with somebody next to you. Have you noticed that girls are treated differently than boys, or that LGBTQ students are treated differently? And some of the ways that that might happen are, you know, do girls get in trouble for what they're wearing in school? Is there a boys will be boys attitude amongst students and teachers if girls are called sexist names? Some of these other things up here. So just take a minute or two to talk with somebody next to you about that. Thanks. Okay, we're going to come back. So hopefully you were able to think of a couple of things. I encourage you to continue to think about this throughout the day. So since this is such a, this is an issue that many people haven't been talking about for many, many years, and now we're finally starting to bring this to the forefront. Many people think that, oh, you know, maybe this, you know, has only just become a problem, but actually this has been an issue that has been very pervasive on campuses for many, many years. And part of why we are just starting to talk about that now is because for a long time survivors have been afraid of coming forward or are unsure of whether they're actually going to be taken seriously. And so some of the things that we really started to notice as survivors were connecting and using a federal law called Title IX, which I'll explain a bit more later, some of the things that we started to notice were how pervasive it was to be ignored by your university and to feel like what happened from the university was worse than the assault itself. And that's not just in the context of the university as well, but also from friends and family and from other groups that you feel are supposed to support you. So this concept of institutional betrayal is the idea that there was some group that you were a part of and they somehow either didn't protect you from this happening to you, or they didn't believe you, or they retaliated against you if it did happen. And so that ends up having really negative psychological consequences. It can make you feel more depressed or anxious or have sleeping problems. And that's why it's so important that as members of our communities that we're supporting survivors when they're coming forward to us, because we want to make sure that survivors are not experiencing the kind of institutional betrayal that is so common from colleges and universities, but also from friends and family and intimate partners. So how do we do that? If there's nothing else that you take away from this presentation today, this is what it is. How to support survivors is to make sure that you make it clear to them that you believe them, that you support them, that it's not their fault, that they're not alone, and to really empower them to make the decision that is right for them. So whether that's seeking counseling or not seeking counseling, or going to law enforcement or not going to law enforcement, or going to a campus proceeding or not doing that, it's all about making sure that that survivor, that person, feels like they're empowered to do what is right for them. Sexual violence is about taking power away from someone. So what's critical in this moment is making sure that they feel that they have the agency to do what is right for them next. Also, a lot of the time, the reaction that a survivor has to trauma might not necessarily make sense. Oftentimes, folks will remember things in fragments or in bits and pieces that are not in chronological order. And that's actually because we process trauma differently as a neurobiological process. So if you want more details about any of this, I'm more than happy to share my presentation with you. I have my email at the end. But it's really what's important to know is that oftentimes our experiences to trauma might be counterintuitive. And so making sure that you're validating how that survivor is feeling is really important. And also being intentional with your language. So not making rape jokes. And if somebody does say that, you know, making it clear that, hey, this, that really upset me. That's not okay to say. And to avoid victim blaming as well. So not saying things about, like, what were you wearing and that kind of thing. It's also really important to know your rights. This law, Title IX, is a law that we have used to connect nationally as survivors and to hold our institutions accountable. But it also applies to high schools and K-12 institutions, mostly public schools and some private schools. So what does this mean? It prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender, which has extended to include sexual harassment and sexual violence, as well as discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation and gender expression. And so if there's a hostile environment on your campus or at your school, say, you know, boys are making fun of the girls in the hallways and, like, pinching their butts and things like that, that would be an instance of a hostile environment that is affecting your access to education. Title IX is a civil rights statute, and so it's all about making sure that you have the access to your education regardless of what gender you identify with. And schools, if they find out about this, they're supposed to address the effects of it. So oftentimes, if you're in the same class as a perpetrator or harasser, you might not be able to concentrate, or you might fear for your safety. And that gets to the heart of what Title IX is making sure that you can pursue your education without that fear. Title II is an intersecting law with Title IX. Title II prohibits discrimination on the basis of ability. So often, students who have experienced sexual violence or harassment will have elevated prevalences of depression and anxiety and other mental health issues, and schools are supposed to provide accommodations for that. Folks who have disabilities are also disproportionately likely to be targeted for sexual violence as well. So even if you haven't experienced sexual violence, but you have a mental health issue like depression or anxiety, your school is supposed to provide accommodations for that if you need them. So in terms of some everyday activism strategies, first of all, I want to say that taking care of yourself should be the utmost priority. This is something that I try to do to the best of my ability as well. You know, this work is really hard. Even if you're not a survivor, it's really difficult to hear these stories and, you know, to grapple with that. It can take a toll on you. So that's the first thing that you need to know, is that it's important to preserve your own health. But in terms of some concrete recommendations that we have as an organization at NRAPE on campus, we recognize that the problem of sexual violence in our culture and on campuses is so complex that it has to be addressed from a variety of angles. So first, we need preventative education. We have to start this conversation long before college. We have to start this conversation before high school. Having education about consent, healthy relationships, bodily autonomy, these things can prevent sexual violence and also teach folks how to support survivors. Having confidential resources available is also really important, since, again, making sure the survivor has the agency to do what's right for them is really important. And having trauma-informed training so that adjudicators and investigators and people who are, you know, going to be trying to resolve these cases within a reporting process know about the neurobiological stuff that I said before, right, about things not making sense because you remember them in different ways, that people know that that exists. And having transparency in campus climate surveys and really prioritizing student feedback is also really important. We can't address this issue if we don't know entirely what it is and whether students are feeling safe on campus or they're not feeling safe on campus, and you know what kinds of experiences are people having when they come forward or when they tell their friends. And one thing that I really want to stress as well with regards to those goals is making sure that your campus is really making a commitment to those things. Are they actually going to be effective? So for instance, with education, is it going to be mandatory? Is it going to be in person? Are people going to be in small groups so they can actually have real conversations about these difficult things? Those kinds of, asking yourselves those kind of questions about, is this a quality measure that the school is taking, or is this just some kind of public relations thing? So all of that being said, I know that's a lot of information. Again, if you want to have this presentation and more detailed information, I'm happy to send it to you. I'll put my email up at the end. But now I want you to turn to the person next to you and share something, one thing that you're going to do to support survivors going forward from today. Just take 1 minute. Great. Thank you so much. Please continue to have these conversations throughout the day. If you want my email address for more detailed recommendations and information, please feel free to send me a message here or to tweet at me. And thank you very much for being here. Have a great rest of your day.